Hello, hello. This is Kinnack coming back to you for the 16th, I believe, Metroplexity podcast, November 2010 edition. I snuck a peek at the questions ahead, and I think that there are already Halloween questions in there. So I'll talk about Halloween when I get to those. And other than that, I don't have like a overarching thing that I need to talk about, so I'll just go ahead and get into the questions. We've got a first batch here from Mag. Carlos and the Vigilante recording agreed that the Renegades attack convoys and people with cars. Since most people in Metroplex who can afford cars are probably affiliated with Midgard, how come Midgard hasn't wiped them out? For the same reason that powerful organizations throughout history have not successfully wiped out outlaw groups. I'm not going to say that it's impossible. It's just, for all intents and purposes, impossible. You can try, but really the best that you can do is kill lots of them. But they never really go away. You kind of have to cut off their sources of income, which in this case would mean either putting a really retarded amount of guards on everyone and everything in the outer rings of Metroplex, or not shipping anything on ground or low altitude drones, which also isn't going to happen. So, when push comes to shove, the final answer for that is that it would be prohibitively expensive for them to wipe it out. But I don't mean that in a Midgard is a bad, like, corporation, like, ha ha ha, we can, save a million credits by letting our employees get killed sort of way. They're doing what they can, but it's just, they're just not going to be able to do that without outlaying some serious bank. It's above and beyond, like, not able to justify it. It's into kind of, like, that's crazy talk land. Maybe even we don't have that kind of money land, depending on how things go. Are they more like guerrilla fighters than a criminal gang, receiving serious firepower from some rival corp? I would say when you're talking about someone who's engaging in more or less banditry, the lines between guerrilla fighting and criminal gang are kind of a question of who you're asking and what their ultimate motivations are. Motivations-wise, they look more like a criminal gang. They're not doing it to hurt Midgard for the sake of hurting Midgard. They're doing it because they don't have jobs, basically. And they can steal more stuff than they could earn and still, like, not have appreciably more risk to their well-being than, trying to work in a Midgard factory or what have you. Is the rating somehow beneficial to Midgard? Yes, kind of. This isn't like the a pressing reason, but it does effectively create a tariff for any goods being shipped into the city over land or low altitude. That's sort of a benefit. But it also does the same thing to any goods being shipped out by Midgard, so it kind of works out in Midgard's favor a little bit. Just because they can more easily control trade coming into and out of the city, because most of it has to come in. Either it is more expensive because of the risk, or is coming through more easily controlled high-altitude airport, basically, routes. And it doesn't hurt them as much as it could, because most of their manufacturing is elsewhere, rather than in Metroplex still, because it's a giant smoking crater where a lot of their production facilities used to be that were in Metroplex. Are there any mysteries you're surprised no one has stumbled upon, solved yet? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that people have done by accident and not figured out how, really. None of that really surprises me. I mean, most of the things that are like that are pretty mean. There's one that continues to kind of amuse me that's, I mean, in one of the, you know, dozens of forum threads on various topics, somebody basically just flat out said, like, oh, we should try this thing, and was, like, maybe a percentage off from the thing that they need to do to get a skill that nobody's found yet. That was quite a while ago. That was, like, months or a year ago. And, yeah, I double-checked, and, yeah, it does work, in case you're curious. But, yeah. Is the Grizzly Crown of Teeth in the Black Book one of those things, like the dead end of the abandoned subway, that we'll have to figure out some other mystery first before we're in a position to figure it out? Not nearly to the same extent, no. It needs a couple of moving parts, and getting one of those moving parts can be a little challenging. But it's nothing too overwhelming. Mushy is an NPC that a lot of us like. Is there more content that we've yet to discover with him? Don't quote me on this, but I'm not coming up with any off the top of my head. More to come someday? Oh, probably. I mean, any time that there's an expansion to the Fey Realms, you'll probably see him get touched on again. Also, he mentions that the Fey recruit by means of books and toys. The toys that we found are the books out there somewhere for us to find, too. They shouldn't be. The original version of his quest, there was going to be sort of a... I was going to do both. But it just ended up being kind of clunky. It was easier just to do the toys. So the books are still hiding out in the ether somewhere. My brain, the ether, not the in-game ether. I get why the Ocean King isn't fussed when you attack him. Seems like just part of fish person culture. How come the King of the Fae is so nonchalant when you're foiling his joy time recruiting scheme? Maybe he depends more on his servants than he lets on? I'm not entirely comfortable with ascribing the Fae with human-like motivations. I mean, they have motivations, and you know some of them, but the way that they go about them and the way that they respond to both successes and difficulties are pretty out there. I would say out of the four races that you can kind of contact with that quest, with David's quest, that the Fae are the ones that are the least human. They'd be like, if I had to cut it down to three, you know, they'd probably be the first ones to get cut, just because they're not really relatable. And any, like, not motivations, but any emotions, I guess, and thought processes that get assigned to them are kind of shaky. And that's part of the reason that the Fae leader actually has that girl as an interpreter, both because they're physically incapable of speech, but also because there's talking to them just wouldn't be a very enlightening process. Is there any reward other than XP for beating the non-etheric tests from the HK Games helmet? No. Pretty sure. there's a thing which you may find that makes me lying on that, but the question that you're actually asking is no. There's an extra thing that you can trigger that's separate from the normal games. The normal games just give you XP. What's in the works for the next unearthly item? Well, it's going to be sort of tied in to the Halloween content, like the Crystal Flame was. It's finally designed. I was like halfway through the design, got stuck for the longest time, and just took yesterday and vegged out and finally like let it churn through with a good solution for me. But it'll be, well, I guess, yeah, it's far enough along design that there are some things that I can legitimately say. It's going to be another, book, like the Encyclopedia of Urban Legends. It grants you a skill and shares the countdown mechanic that, the Encyclopedia skill has, the Urban Lore skill. But obviously, gives you different stuff. I think it'll be pretty interesting. And there's a lot of stuff that I still have to do for it. So I would expect to see that. I was going to do it this weekend, but it's, you know, halfway through Sunday already, and I'm not even halfway done with the design. Well, with the development. So it'll probably be a bit still. Thankfully, Monday, people should be done hammering on my roof. Which has just, like, driven me to the edge of madness. I'm not sure if I said this out loud. If I'm repeating myself, I apologize. But we're having our roof torn off and replaced, and I work from home for my, you know, day job. And trying to do my day job, which isn't, like, you know, scintillating to begin with. As, you know, day jobs are wont to be. While people are hammering constantly, just for, like, you know, good solid 12 hours a day, you know, 8 of which I'm trying to work, is not conducive to being a functional human being, I've found. But yeah, my complaining aside, that should be, that's in the works. That's sort of what it'll look like. Let's see. What with things finally moving again on the Feathered Cloak front, once again thinking about the possibility of a bird avatar, how many unfound avatars are lurking out there these days? Well, let me take a look. Well, it looks like you've found 12? Is that right? I'll assume that's right, because that's what the database says. And there are currently 24. Minus one for the cyborg, which is still not implemented. And minus one for another one that I'm not entirely sure is implemented. So we're looking at 22, 23. So you've got a little over half of them. So, 22. There are two that are in the list, but not implemented yet. So you've got 10 to find, it looks like. XGive has a couple questions here. Will there ever be bigger, more apartments? I already have some 6 items to install, and room for only 3. Enough room in my inventory to carry arbitrary large amount of all of them and more, even when I'm in the apartment itself. Well, I mean, aside from the fact that you are going to have an infinite inventory, whether you want it or not, there's certainly a difference between, like, having a box of IKEA parts and having, like, your dresser. That aside, the answer to the actual question there is that, yes, there will be bigger or more apartments, bigger or different. I don't really plan to have people have multiple homes. Actually, there's some stuff in the coding that would make explode. But the I'm waiting for that to become irritating before I really start worrying about that. So yeah. It's obviously becoming irritating, but it'll probably have to become a little more irritating before I actually do that. I mean, I don't want to roll out, you know, 4 and 5 sized apartments until people actually, like, until enough people want them to, like, bother to go through the hoops to get them to, you know, actually have that be, to have be coding it be worth it. But it will happen eventually. It's just, you know, just not going to do it until there's a lot of furniture fighting for people's space. Which isn't to say that if I release them right now, there would be a 6 to accommodate you. It's supposed to make you make choices on what stuff that you want. So the fact that you need to choose 3 items out of 6 is good. And it will, I mean, maybe like 4 or 5 out of 6 might also be okay-ish. But we're looking more at probably like when it gets to, you know, 4 out of 8, or something like that. Is achromatic equipment guaranteed to salvage and get achromatic ingots? For the purposes of your question, yes. I guess all of the achromatic equipment that's salvageable, which is, I believe, all of the achromatic equipment they've found, salvages to achromatic ingots and achromatic ingots only. I just didn't want to, you know, throw a online fest back at someone. I thought that was already found, but I might be totally off my rocker there. Will there be monochromatic masses? Bichromatic? Trichromatic? Prismatic? I just really like the word achromatic. I'm a big fan. Assuredly be sort of equivalent rewards for the Survivors Reset Contest. I'm not sure if they'll follow the same sort of approach necessarily. And it's not as though I haven't gotten yelled at enough for the achromatic masses. I shouldn't really say that. It's really just Argot that's been hassling me about those. Everyone else seems to be A-okay. To rephrase that, Argus has already yelled at me enough about the achromatic masses. But I don't expect to do, like, exactly the same thing with a different flavor coating for later contests. It's sort of, I want to kind of keep them tied to the theme of the contest, to the extent that that even makes sense to anyone other than me. Some questions from Al. Thoughts on Halloween? It was awesome. That was him saying it was awesome, not me. I would also generally agree that it was awesome. I was a little disappointed that there was some content that didn't get rolled out for Halloween proper. But it was actually content for basically a clear Eclipse victory, which is not what happened. So it didn't end up being relevant at all. So there were a bunch of combats that just didn't get put in that also were never triggered, so it didn't end up mattering. I was just a little peeved with myself for not getting that out in time. Because it was pretty neck and neck, which is why it didn't trigger those. But if it had gone from being neck and neck to being a clear theoretic victory, I would have been in a bad spot. But that didn't happen, so... I thought that actually everything went really well. The lead-up contest with the selling candy, I thought, was really well-received. People really seemed to enjoy the hacking aspect of that, which I had a lot of fun making. The lead-up stuff with, getting the stage built and then transitioning to, the stage is built, getting, the wiring and the speakers and bringing down the barrels of punch and so forth. People seemed pretty pleased with that. The differences in the volunteer force this year, being the hipsters, the punks, and the security guards. Not the security guards are technically volunteers, because, well, actually you can get some of them to volunteer. But I'm not sure anybody actually figured out the other half of that. Yeah, well. But that, I think the difference in there was pretty interesting. And there, it was interesting to see how the sides broke down, in that there were a lot of people doing security, a lot of people stashing clips, and basically everybody working on building. There was a case for, basically if the side for destroying everything did better than the side for building stuff, everything being just a complete fucking mess. And that was just, like, blown away, not gonna happen, like just not even remotely chance of that occurring. Which I mean, like, who wants a riot, when you could have, like, I guess either a nice party or an etheric hellhole. Which is really kind of where the fighting occurred. So yeah, that was pretty cool. And then Halloween itself, I mean, there was some stuff that I didn't get a chance to code, which didn't happen, so that was fine. There was some stuff that I did get a chance to code that just didn't happen. And there was some stuff that I got a chance to code that was available, and I don't think anybody found. So, that's kind of neat. Before you yell at me about that, I actually have a nefarious plan on that front to not waste that content. Or really, more specifically, that art, because it is amazing. It'll be a while before you see it, but you'll be stoked when you see it, I'm pretty sure. So, I think that went really well, and everyone seemed, like, really happy with the stuff that they got to do and received. What's next in store for us? This is mostly Landon being totally just, like, strung out from people hammering on his roof, talking, but I'm really planning on taking November largely off, because I've kind of got, like, Halloween on one side and Christmas on the other, and it seems like the appropriate solution for the middle months to chill. I would still like to get the donation item out, obviously, and so hopefully I'll get to do that. And there's a couple of other neat things that I'd like to do that I'm just not sure if they're going to get done or not. I'm not really going to push it. There's a small area revamp I'd like to do, and And by small area revamp, I mean completely revamping a small area rather than having a small revamp of an area. It'll be awesome, and I've been wanting to do it for like a year or something. It's been ridiculous, but we'll see how that goes. What was the other thing that I was thinking about? Oh, and there's some stuff I'd like to do with simple crafting, if I get a chance. But yeah, that's, so, I mean, aside from the donation I'm coming in, and maybe some neat stuff, if I can, well, really, if I get excited about it, so I don't burn myself out before we get to Christmas, and then Christmas. Christmas should be pretty cool. Let's see. Is there anything to do with the Black Sketchbook quest which requires stuff from outside the sketchbook, or is it all self-contained? Are there more items to be found? I think you already know the answer to the first two questions. But if you actually mean is there undiscovered stuff that requires stuff from outside the quest book, the sketchbook, yes. There is depends on how you count. There is at least one, maybe three, depending on how you count. There are pretty much three undiscovered things with the quest book that I'm thinking, the sketchbook that I'm thinking about. And one of those absolutely requires, and one of them kind of dubiously requires, and one of them kind of dubiously requires. So, and yeah, there's, are there any more items to be found? If you mean the stuff in, like, the quest list, items to be found, I think so. I think one of those shows up in that list, one of the things that I was just mentioning. There are three mysteries left in the sketchbook quest that, that I can come up with off the top of my head. All three of them are mean. Two of them, I don't... Well... one of them... nobody has any, like, even, like, remote, maybe, leads on. Which is kind of funny, because it would have helped in Halloween. But, one of them... people will probably kill me for when they figure it out, but they don't have any leads on. And, one of them is the one that Mag asked me about with the crystal thing. So, yeah. I would say that the grizzly crown is the most obvious one, and the other two are pretty, pretty dubious. Let's see. Did you plan all the numbers out for the Halloween event ahead of time, or do you adjust things on the fly? Just to say, what would you have done if the stage hadn't been built on time? Most of the numbers for Halloween were comparative, so it wasn't a question of you need to get, you know, 500 things done. It was that, you know, you've done 500 things, you've got, like, you know, 2,500 points from it, effectively. And that is, you know, more than, is that less than, more than, or way, way more than, the opposing things. So it was really, it wasn't really a question of meeting goals, it was mostly a question of, just which direction the player base wanted to go, basically. The exception for that was actually the stage. I think... might have been the only one. At least the only one that was nearly that important. I mean, there are some things that, like, incremented and then decremented back down, like, the number of security guards you got or whatever. But that was the only one that really had a set goal number. And if you hadn't finished the stage, basically it would have been a complete mess. And I mean, would have more or less knocked the have a like nice contained sense making party more or less out of the running. But yeah, there wouldn't have been a stage at Halloween if you hadn't finished the stage. And there's some later encounters in the setup that obviously wouldn't have occurred. But yeah, no, it was totally possible. Let's see. How much detail does Pio get? Do you describe the pictures in detail or just give her a rough idea? Usually what she'll get is a couple paragraphs and a few links to pictures that I think are kind of close. Or if it's based off, you know, other art that she's already done, I'll just drop that in there. Occasionally it'll be something really just like, you know, draw this object for me. Here's a link to a picture of this object. Just draw it, call it a day. And there are a bunch of examples that leap to mind, but I haven't used the art for any of them yet. So, I guess let me go back in time a little bit. Oh, like the baseball bat icon. It's like, yeah, draw me a baseball bat. Here's a picture of a baseball bat. Go. And so, yeah, most of the time I provide a fair amount of guidance. I try really hard not to over-describe things. I tend to also give her a lot of outs. Like, you know, like, if you think it would look good, try this. But if you don't think it would look good, I'm not really married to it, right? That sort of thing. Although, as we discussed in the last podcast, my instructions are usually, like name of the image, and then, like, the scales that I wanted in, like, 25 by 25, 50 by 50, 100 by 100. And so, like, it'll be, like, you know, for this, you know, 25 by 25, 50 by 50, you know, I want, like, pool cue, right? It's like, and, you know, the 50 by 50 can have some blood on it, and I don't think the pool cue is that bad. Oh, the hammer one is the one that always really misses me, just like the normal claw hammer, which is, you know, a couple hammer items. Maybe just one hammer item. Yeah, I think practically just one hammer item. But, and then the, like, horrible, bloody power strike image. Because the 50 by 50 is almost always. If I'm doing them for something that I think will end up being a melee technique, it'll be like, and you know, the 50 by 50 can have blood on it. And it's always just like, yeah, I'm not sure if that amuses anyone else as much as it amuses me, but it definitely amuses me. What's this Z drug? Will we ever see it? Long story short, it's a stimulant that's used largely in the clubbing scene, but it's not used in the, like, university clubbing scene. It's a little upscale for that. It's used mostly by folks downtown, which is why you haven't run into it yet, and why you will run into it. And I think Carlos says that. At least that's where he used to sell it. Does the paper boat do anything at all? Oops, sorry, I totally skipped like three questions. I've always really enjoyed how you bring the game and the metagame together. For example, both other players and NPCs can send you messages using the same interface or using hacking to see the Halloween leaderboards. It's the little things like these that really set this game apart from others. Thanks. I would normally yell at you for putting something there that wasn't a question, but I, you know, any praise coming this way, I'll try not to argue with too much. If I recall correctly, the old Two Roads encounter got easier each try you did it. Is this still true, or am I just unlucky? It didn't... that's actually true now and was not true before. The way that it worked before, which I guess I can tell you now that it doesn't work that way anymore, is there were tests for the attributes, which I'm sure you figured out. And if you failed the test, you might get the fail message for that test, basically. And then if you've tried it at least once, there's another option that you just get through, right? So even if you fail one of the tests, or more of the tests, and you just, the more of the tests you pass, the less likely it is you fail, basically, up to 100% success. But it actually just becomes easier now as you try it, which I think makes sense. And probably more sense than it did before. And encourages less... I'm sure that people will... Well, I'm not going to say that I'm sure that people will help me with this. There are sort of two schools of thought on this. And one of them is that you shouldn't just, like, fail people, basically. And one of them is that giving people a chance for success, even though they really haven't succeeded, is a degenerative situation. By which I mean it encourages people to just try it over and over again until it lets them through. The equivalent of, you know, taking 20 in a 3rd edition D&D. So the previous one let people take 20. It doesn't actually let you do that now. You have to actually either pass or cheat your way through the tests. And the tests do get some easier as you go. As you fail. So, like, there's a little bit of give and take there in between them. Maybe I'm just a big softy. I don't know. So, yeah, if you failed more than, like, 3 or 4 times, I would, you know, maybe try something else. I mean, whatever that might be for you. But, yeah. That's not the way that the old one worked. Any chance we could keep our simple recipes when we reset? Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a bug, now that I think about it. I mean, in the sense that it's working exactly the way that I coded it, but not the way that it should be. Yeah, I can fix that. That's not a big deal. Does the paper boat do anything at all? I keep meaning to make it do something. Not, like, anything useful. Just, like, something awesome. And by awesome, I for very limited definitions of awesome. But no, it's not really intended to be earth-shattering. Just a paper boat. Why doesn't Helga back the... I'm just vetoing this question. I've answered that, like, way more times than I'm interested in. Would it be too crowded to add a date column to the seasonal leaderboards? I'd like to be able to sort them by date to see the new entries. I could add that for next board. Currently it doesn't exist. Do most of the remaining avatars require PvP to unlock them? man, some of these are great. And some of these have the best image names ever. But the, most of them do require PvP in one way or another. I would say, looks like there's one that doesn't require PvP at all. Okay, but not all of them are actually gained in PvP fights, so don't come back and stab me or anything. Oh, oops, I skipped over a question, but I'm not going to answer it anyway. But just for the sake of reference, the question that I'm not answering is, do opponents draw from a real infinitely large deck, or do they choose from a pre-select pattern of techniques? And I'm just not interested in answering that. By far the most common question new players ask is there a way to sell my junk items? I'm sort of answered this at least a dozen times now. Consider adding it to the FAQ. I have considered it and rejected it. I'm not honestly even really sold on the idea of having an FAQ, to be perfectly blunt. If you are getting that question from people and they have checked the info page first, tell me and I will go ahead and revamp the info page at some point. But in my experience, people don't look anyway, so it's kind of a waste of everyone's time and effort to put anything into it. Maybe that's just me arguing in bad faith, but the number of times that I've received received comments or gotten, or like threads like, oh my god, this great thing happens or works, or, you know, this weird interface thing exists, that are already in the page. Yeah, it just doesn't really. Maybe, you know, it's dampening things down and that's just like the leftovers, but the impression that I get is that nobody's reading it anyway, so, you know. Running out of options at the end of comments seems like it was changed to be too powerful now, automatically getting beaten up. Why not make it so that if you run out of options, you get one less chance to run away, and if you lose, you get beaten up, and if you win, you get to run away? It doesn't make a ton of sense to get dragged under by a tiny rat if you have 100 hit points but run out of moves too early. I think if you're running out of moves against a tiny rat, you totally deserve to get your ass kicked. It's the moral of the story there. Maybe that makes me a bad person, but, I mean, if you're using even bare minimum 15 techniques against, you know, some cute, harmless little rat and not killing it, I think you deserve to get your ass kicked, and in the most humiliating way possible. I mean, there are better examples there, I think, like the Bat Swarm, which is a giant flippin' pain in the ass, and should probably get changed to work differently, but is a giant flippin' pain in the ass, but which, you know, like, obviously, like, you're not hurting it, and you're not getting away, so it's not as bad to get, you know, eaten alive by bats, Yeah, I don't think that really bugs me, to be perfectly blunt. I think that if that is harsh enough to ever make someone say, oh, I should not have just 15 techniques in this deck, that means it's harsh enough. Yeah, I don't see any honest real need to change that. For the Fetid Cloak and the HK Game Talent, do the encounters that appear to have a random element to them, or should we be... Do the encounters that appear have a random element to them, or should we be looking for more of a pattern that we've yet to find? I assume you mean the timing between them? Because clearly you can control which of the encounters you get. Like when you actually get the encounter. Yeah, and I'm just gonna go out on a limb here and assume that you're talking about the timing. And the timing there is partially random. And there's a bunch of, you know, random and counter-random things that are going on there. But there's an interesting line, I think, in design, for this type of game in particular, between... You want things to be optimizable. You want things to be, you know, interesting and, you know, like a little fiddly when people want them to be fiddly. But you have to just kind of accept the fact that people will optimize. Well, no, people is overly broad. That there is a subset of players who will optimize even if it hurts themselves. Like, they will hate playing the game in an optimized fashion, but they will still optimize it. And I mean, you can basically just tell them to go F, or you can design it in such a way that you just, you know, put up giant middle fingers in place of certain abilities to optimize. And I think that that's one of those, I mean, depending on, obviously, like, what those control mechanisms were, but if it were just, like, a countdown, I think that that could be pretty harsh. Or, at the very least, it would have to be something that would be, clearly displayed, rather than hidden and non-random. If it's visible and non-random, that's okay, maybe not the way I would do it if I were designing it today, like with the puzzle box. Although I think it works for the puzzle box. Neither here nor there. Or it can be hidden and at least partially random. Because if it's something that you can say this will occur in 41 energy, you're going to have people who rightfully, and I'm not trying to be hard on these people, who rightfully will want to be tracking that, and you get kind of two faces there, one of which is that they're just going to, like, there's not going to be any actual mystery there once it's fixed up, right, figured out, right, because they'll just do, like, a grease monkey script or something. And then on the other hand, you've got the people who are just not going to be, who are just going to be discouraged by the fact that they're not being as optimal as they could be. Whereas if it's just like, you know, it'll be, you know, between like 30 and 50 energy or whatever. That's not an actual example, but like I said 41 before, so it's like somewhere between 30 and 50 energy instead. That's something that more you can just get a feel for. It's like, it's about time-ish. Maybe I'll be getting another encounter around here somewhere. So I think I actually answered your question, too. Yeah. Okay. So we've got another batch from Slag Runner, also known as Glass, who is one of our guests last time, which was exciting in the Con of the Cob Metroplexity suite. I recently started playing Shadowrun 4 and love it. To me, it's the same old Shadowrun I know and love with a fresh coat of paint and the game mechanics. I would tend to agree with that. Plus, it's got some snazzy tweaks to the game setting based on a more intuitive vision of a dystopian future. Keeps a better pace with today's technology and scope of the modern future. I think how they adapted to a lot of that stuff is really interesting. Like the wireless matrix, when like wireless basically took over the world, which nobody was really expecting, even like as it sort of started happening, let alone when Shadowrun was originally put out. And it's interesting to see how they adapt the corporation set they have to match current, like, geopolitical situations. Like, in the original Shadowrun, either 4 or 5 of the corporations were Japanese-based of the megacorps, which is, like, half-ish. And since then, I think, like, one has either fallen from grace or fallen from grace to come back. One got, maybe the same one even, got replaced by Luxing, which is a Chinese firm, rather than a Japanese firm. And one of the firms moved to Russia, moved to Vladivostok, if I recall correctly. So it's sort of, like, in old-school cyberpunk, it's just assumed Japanese will take over the world, which I kind of give a nod with Zaibatsu. But it is interesting how they're sort of keeping up with the times there. Anyway, back to Playground Crusher. Anyway, as I was digesting the material, I was wondering how you envision the topology of the net in the Matrix. When we jack into the net, are we experiencing the net in sort of a VR cyber-friendly environment? Or is the whole hacking procedure played out on the tiny screens of our PDAs? It depends, and I think that you can kind of hopefully maybe tell it depends by some of the things that grant code finesse. Typically, I mean, bare bones, if you're going in with, like, just your PDA and nothing of great interest, you're going to be, you're going to just be doing it off the PDA screen. And then as you add more items, like, you know, the Twitch visor, things like that, you're going to have those, start to have more of that interconnectivity. But as a general rule, VR in Metroplex's timeline is not as advanced as VR in a lot of sci-fi timelines or cyberpunk timelines. And maybe this is just, you know, me being a grognard or something, but I've just never felt like the immersive virtual reality that you see in most of these things is either going to be it's really just kind of one thing. It's not going to be as pervasive as they say, or as like on tap as they say. And I think that's reflected a lot through the way that the neural recordings work. I mean, you have to jump through a couple of hoops, but more so, you have to kind of go to the font. You have to get to Zaibatsu either through, you know, piracy or what have you. Somebody at some point gave Zaibatsu a ton of money to create a given neural recording. And I mean, they're like rich, stupid people still, obviously. So, you get some stuff that's still just dumb. At the end of the day, the ability to create streaming, virtual reality just isn't out there. Certainly not for hacking purposes. I always picture, this is me actually knowing too much about actual hacking, but I picture the actual hacking interface that you're using as not really suffering from being on a PDA. It really just doesn't matter at all. It's mostly like, you can get some skins on it, so to speak, but if you're just talking plugging your PDA in without any programs, you're just command lining it. Basically. Also, do you envision the interconnectivity of the net share the same wireless capacities as Matrix 2.0, or does it rely on groundwork of fiber optic webbing? A little column A, a little column B. Pervasive wireless, but the actual backbone stuff is still cable, still physical cable. And then obviously you have secured sites like Midgard uses, which is a sort of a curse and a blessing for them. A blessing in that they can just shoot people who want to hack into their networks, and a curse in that they tend to rely a little bit too much on shooting the people who want to hack into their networks. And when that doesn't work, things kind of go south a bit. Have you ever considered using a 25 scale party crowd .jpg instead of the default image .jpg for the dance music effect? Let me see if that scales okay. Yeah, it looks alright. Alright, done. What's up with the sparkling blood? Does the effect simply play the role of a drawback consequence of getting too much energy drug use for so little body, or is there some hidden benefit that can be derived from the effect? Yes, mostly column A. I mean, there's some... there's some tricky stuff that you can do there, but it's almost entirely Calmway. Is the Metro's company that makes the public transit system the same Metro's that makes Metroplex's beer? I think I'm going to go with yes for that. It's when I was originally designing them, I didn't really think about it very much. But even, like, the second and third tier megacorps, or just corps, as people in Metroplex call them, are really... kind of have their fingers in everything. Like, they have their areas of expertise, certainly. Like, Midgard does drones. But they also have, like... I mean, their security forces, which aren't really anything to write home about, but are there. And they produce a lot of... I mean, like, they produce some candy, they produce, you know, some clothing, they produce weapons, they produce armor, they produce... medicines, you know, like, basically, like, if there is a service or product, chances are very good that any given megacorp will produce it. So you ask about Shadowrun, now I'm using the wrong terminology. But even, like, the Midgard is kind of second tier, which is to say that it's not Omnitech or Zaibatsu, and Metros is kind of third tier. But I think that it works out pretty well to have the subways and, like, transportation being run by the same people as the breweries. What's the approximate conversion rate of credits to American dollars? As with other game systems that use universal monetary units, I always wondered if there's a small, if that's the smallest denomination of money, or is there a fractional credit unit like nickels or dimes that isn't featured in the game? The conversion rate, I don't really think of there as being one, honestly. You might be able to figure one out. But the assumption that I make is that a lot of the prices have moved a lot. There have been some pretty serious upheavals in how things are produced. Like the... much of the agriculture is drone-based now, rather than using human labor. So a lot of the staple food products prices have dropped a lot. But at the same time, so much more wealth is concentrated in the hands of the rich and ultra-rich that any sort of luxury good is really kind of hyperinflated. And I think you can see that to some extent just in the pricing in the game, hopefully. But any sort of conversion, like if you were converting a, there are kind of a couple different standard baskets of goods that are used for those sorts of things, and a real standard basket would give you a pretty weird answer, whereas a standard basket that focused on actual, like, necessities, like food stampy type stuff, and, like, you know, rent and whatnot, would probably show a decrease, like, in amount of time you'd have to work. Well, that's not even really accurate. Yeah, prices are just kind of all over the place. And, I mean, like, you're squatting, but, like, a lot of places the rent has gone up and so forth. Just because so many people are coming into the cities from outlying areas, because there aren't really any jobs in outlying areas anymore. And as far as fractional units, I mean, there definitely are fractional units. I don't think people use them like normal individuals use them. So it's not like a dollar where, like, everyone uses, you know, quarters sometimes. But it's more like, you can get, like, fractions of cents in banking transactions and things like that, where you can get, like, fractions of credits and those sorts of transactions. It might... I'm not thinking that the average person would ever really need to do that. You certainly could, the credits, generally, you're talking about are just stored on your comm. So if you needed to send somebody, like, a tenth of a credit. You could, without too much hassle. It's just, I don't think it comes up very often. Can we get a hint or two about what we have to look forward to this Christmas? Metroplexamus? More Togusness? I think that the basic backbone of Christmas is pretty well established. In that you're going to have the Abominable Snowman contest. And that's going to hopefully be awesome. And I'm going to try some new things there, but probably more along the lines of the difference between last year's Metroplexity Day and this year's Metroplexity Day than between last year's Halloween and this year's Halloween. Which is to say that last year's Halloween and this year's Halloween was basically all new content. And this year's Metroplex Day was mostly was old content with a couple of new things thrown in. So let's see. Oh, there is sort of another half of Christmas that I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to deal, being the acquisition of trees. First year was pretty much there was just non-combat counter gave you your tree. And then last year there was a sort of a blockade at the docks that had to be cleared, and it was just cleared really quickly, to the extent that it wasn't really worth the time or effort. To either make the choice interesting to, like, sneak past them and steal a tree, or really, you know, bother to code it. So I'm not sure if I'm going to... That's either going to become more interesting and more complicated, or it's going to go back to being really simple. I'm not quite sure which yet. Had enough questions yet? Well, we're at about an hour, so I guess I have. What is best in life? To drag your enemies before you and listen to lamentations of their women. And I think there's another thing in there. Maybe, like, burn their villages or something. Clearly. Totally miss hanging out with you, Liz and Puyo. I hope I can plan a trip back to Ohio sometime in February, maybe? Let's see, as long as it's not... Oh, I should mention this. I'm planning, and by I'm actually mostly meaning my mother-in-law, who is awesome. Not a sentence that I think that gets used often enough. My mother-in-law is, in fact, really cool. I will come back to a random advice column, a note later, but, so we're planning on blanking on whether it's February into March or March into April. I think it's March into April. Vacation down to Australia, which promises to be pretty sweet. 3 weeks-ish. So there, at some point in like the first couple of months of the year, there will be a several-week span where, obviously I'm not going to be getting any development done, where bug reports will also be really slow. We'll see how that goes. But it's going to be awesome, so, yeah. Questions from Striper. Relative newbie here. That's all right. Please ask. But I was wondering, with all the drugs in the games, the variety of them, you'd think that there would be at least one or two drugs that the body would be able to build a tolerance to, causing them to have a lesser effect with more uses, or as different effect from habitual use. There really should. I have a couple of things like that, but they're actually all on... food, which is a little weird. any chance that a mechanic like that will be implemented much higher now, at least on drugs. Like I said, I had them on... I'm weird. Whereas PC mods are so altered that it doesn't produce the normal drug tolerance you'd expect. There's the normal sort of drug tolerance that you'd get, you're not going to see too much of. I mean, both from a they're your player character's body are pretty weird, but also because, wow, that would be a giant pain in the ass. I don't want people to have to, you know, like, reset to clear their drug tolerance counters or anything like that. Because that just seems mean. But no, like, there should definitely be at least some... Actually, this goes back to a semi-interesting design story. Maybe semi-interesting. When I was actually originally working on the game, I was considering between one of two options for body. Where one option was basically... Well, one option is what we have now. And the other option was more or less separate counters. And those counters interacting in different ways. Like if you, you know, if you took too much... this is actually where the jitters effect comes from, originally, design-wise. If you took too much, too many stimulants, you would get a negative effect from that. And that would get, you know, slowly worse. And if you took, you know, if you mixed things, that could cause problems, things like that. Which is really, like, thought-provoking and, like, interesting in a, like, mental exercise sort of sense. But really would have, I think, been a giant pain. And I think actually more importantly than that, having it be a limited resource shared between all of them means that, you know, you can get more energy, or you can save energy by, you know, beating enemies consistently with buffs, or you can save energy by taking, you know, the etheric route through things, or some combination of the above, you know, based on the items you have, and, you know, the throw chemistry in there. It becomes this, actually, I think, really very interesting, like, resource management sort of mini-game that's going on there. And by mini-game, I almost mean, like, macro-game. Like, it's... I mean, when push comes to shove, the real, like, crux of the game, to a large extent, is energy management. Which body and hunger play into really heavily. Is there an ETN when cyberware content might go in? As of the moment, there's only one piece of cyberware in the game that I know of, and it's unusable at this time. Yep, that's been around for a bit. If it makes you feel better, there were a bunch of PDAs for a long time that weren't usable either. One of them actually from the same guy. Which made getting his drops, I think, really kind of funny. Like, you kill this guy, and it's like, oh, I got this PDA that doesn't do anything at this arm that I can't even beat people to death with. As far as the actual ETA, it should be in before I roll out the Old Town quest, which is the next step in the main quest line. But there's a bunch of stuff that's going in, sort of, in there. And the Old Town quest is probably quite ways off. Maybe, like, mid-next year is a random guess, so sometime before then. It's going to be kind of interesting, because there's only really one place to get cyberware before the Old Town quest, and you actually get that through Boris. And they don't really... They don't really do cyberware the normal way. The main, like, I guess, almost like interface piece for cyberware is in Old Town. Like, the main cyberware clinic that'll be available to PCs is in Old Town, which is why you haven't really seen it implemented yet. There's also a university clinic that you can do, like, you know, experimental trials and things like that. Thanks for your questions. First time in it. Alright. A question from Voles, which... Alright. Voles, I'm just gonna read this and we'll see if I actually have any comment. In ancient times, the Pontificus Maximus decreed how long the break between years would be, a few days belonging to no month or season. What would you say, I guess we're out of the funny voice, what would you say to 1 week a year where Zach gave you all of your unearthly items under setting and sold any that you hadn't been permanently removed from rotation? The fastest resetter of the silly holiday could have the honor of wearing the Pontifex's silly hat until next year. I think that that's not a terrible idea on face. I would rather get things working, moving on the resettiness before we do that. So if I were going to do that, it would be between rotation cycles. Like, so if... All right, let's... I'm going to go in... We're just going to use a metaphor for a second. Okay, so if we assume that each season is like a zodiac sign, so like we're in, I don't know, we'll say Virgo now. So like, you know, we go like Leo and then whatever's after Leo. I only remember the order of two zodiac signs, so this is probably a bad example. But when we were about to come back into Virgo from whatever's before Virgo, that would not be a terrible place to put something like that. But that's a ways off. But no, I could see something like that as a periodic holiday. Couple questions from Dare Magus. Is there some trick to killing the Ocean King? Oh, I actually already kind of have answered this question. In that there's a discussion page on the Ocean King that has like the stats and the strategies of a bunch of people who have killed him. So, I mean, is there some trick? Kinda. I mean, the battle works best if you engage it in a certain way, but it's not... I don't think there's any... It's not anything on the order of, like, the twined firework serpents from Metroplex Day or anything. It's just... a boss fight, really. Some person reports beating him twice with after-run stats twice. Oops, I'm sorry, I misread the sentence. Some person reports beating him with after-run stats twice. That doesn't terribly surprise me. I mean, if you load up with the right defensive equipment and really, I mean, like, even the damaging sort of side of things. Choose your targets wisely and I would say probably worry more about defense than offense because you're fighting against three enemies. It might not be the end of the world to use area of effect attacks, but I don't think there are any that work underwater. I might be wrong there. Because most of them are, like, you know, explosives, and that's usually a little weird underwater. Let's see. I failed miserably several times with all stats over 50 and every buff that's available. You're probably doing something wrong then, I'm guessing. It really brings me to the point of saying, screw it, grabbing all skills but the one that needs him killed and stopping there, because really just depressing. Well, sorry that's depressing. But... Well, I guess now would be a good time to talk about, I guess, boss design a little bit. I think that boss design is something that's really interesting, just as a subset of game design, because you've got a number of options I'm coming up with four-ish off the top of my head. You can have the traditional RPG boss, which is basically like this wall, and until you kill the wall, you can't get past. And I don't think we actually have any of those. I'm not sure actually how we could have any of those, because I'm pretty sure you can get through without killing anyone now. So, yeah. So, presumably we don't have any of those. At least in the main quest line. You have, you know, optional bosses, which, I mean, are handled in most games as, like, you know, bosses and side quests, but I also mean, like, bosses like the Ganger boss, where you can, you know, either kill the guy, or just hit, you know, let him go, call it a day. And there are, like, one-time bosses, like Chardon. Saber. Totally blanked on his name for a second there. And there was probably a fourth one that I was thinking of before. But those are really the ones that kind of what I'm talking about. And I think that it's really interesting how, between those three, they'll all, you'll get really, really vicious, feedback out of all three of them. I mean, varying degrees, obviously, but, like, there's a, I mean, like, you know, this isn't, like, you know, Deramagus isn't, like, overreacting or being mean or anything, but it's, I mean, it can be, people will get really frustrated with, you know, the optional bosses just as much as they will with a boss that's just a static wall, and they'll get also just as frustrated with the bosses that are, like, one time, you know, succeed or fail, you know, the quest advances, which I think is really interesting. I was not... So, when I designed the university quest, I was expecting that people would get pretty ticked off with Shard and Shrapnel. And, I mean, they have. To varying extents, I should say. Like, some people absolutely love them. I've heard from players who use that as part of their sales pitch. Like, you know, like, if you fail to rescue a hostage, you know, they get shot in the fucking head. Unlike, you know, every other RPG ever, where you can, like, keep fighting the guy standing next to the hostage, and the hostage never gets hurt. Which kind of makes them not a hostage at that point, and just kind of, like, a guest. Like, you know, bust out the tea table. Not to say that I wouldn't totally do that if I thought it was better for the game, but it's just one of those things that completely breaks immersion for me. But there are other things that also completely break immersion for me that I'm totally willing to do, like having an infinite inventory, because the game isn't about inventory management. So I knew that, and I knew that if I had... I'm specifically thinking about the docks, the gang boss, in the sewers there. If I had him as a wall, so to speak, boss, people would complain about that. I mean, they would not be able to beat him, and they would get really frustrated, because I can't advance the quest, which is totally legitimate, as is people complaining about Shard and Saber, but what I did not expect, I guess, is the number of people who I've gotten feedback from about the ganger boss trying to beat him over and over, despite him being optional. Despite there being, like, a just let him go and call it a day option, which I think is really interesting. I'm guessing that it's some mix of having to win and expecting to have to fight the boss, right? I mean, the ability to just say, you know, like, fuck it, you can leave, is kind of weird for this sort of game. So, like, in retrospect, I can totally see, like, why that happens. Like, why people do keep trying to beat him, do get really frustrated. But I wasn't expecting it when I put that boss in. But I guess the other half of this that I think is really important, specifically with the Ocean King, is that you have these optional difficult bosses that are, I'm not going to say all upside, but, like, kind of a wash. I mean, you get a skill out of that quest, regardless of whether you beat him or not. And, I mean, the skill that you get with him is arguably better, but, you know, it's kind of same old, right? But I think that it is really important for a game to have bosses that are really fucking hard. That not everybody necessarily can beat. And I don't necessarily mean this in a limited time content sense, like the Fireworks Dragons. They just didn't get beat because they didn't get beat. But with the design of the Ocean King, I went into it wanting that to be a really hard fight. Because I think it's important to recognize people who can beat those really hard fights. And whether that's by, you know, sheer cussedness and powering through, which I don't think it is for the most part, or if it's by, you know, figuring out the intricacies of this fight, or, you know, loading up the right equipment, right buffs, or whatever. However they end up beating this fight, I think that it's important to have some fights out there that kind of say, you know, we salute you, right? And, you know, whether they're, like, unique items in those fights, or skills, or, you know, techniques, kind of, maybe, or avatars, you know, whatever. Like the Valentine's Killer Avatar. Might be called Quatsick Avatar, I forget. And yeah, I think that that's, I don't know. I think that having those fights, and having those fights be optional is really kind of important. Are both important. So, I don't foresee any real, like, wall boss fights, ever, because I would like to have the game be beatable, with the non-violent, although possibly completely obnoxious route, but I foresee having, you know, bosses that you can really only try once, whether, you know, they run away or get, you know, executed by their superiors or whatever. And bosses that you can circumvent in various ways. Or, you know, all of the above. In the case, really, of Saber and Shard, who you can either circumvent or fight once, or, you know, whatever. Obviously, these are kind of blurry. But I also think that it's really important to have a couple of really hard fights. And I don't think that those should entirely come from gang warfare. Although, obviously, it's a good source for really hard fights. Because some player's going to lose each of those fights. I guess unless you tie, in which case you're kind of both losing, I don't know. I think it's actually recorded as you both losing and both winning, but I forget. But yeah, so that's where I stand on that. Kind of wandered far afield, but I'm empirically confident that the Ocean King is beatable. I also, I mean, there are some things in the fight that make it maybe technically interesting, but not, like, really tricky. And I guess the last thing that I would say about that is that I would not mind, when I designed that fight, I knew that if I screwed up the balance with the level that I was balancing it at, it was entirely possible that it would not be a beatable fight for some length of time. Like, either when some new content came out, some new unearthly items, or, like, when the next step in the main quest line came out. when Old Town came in. And I'm totally okay with that. We haven't had to think that happen, really. But the idea that you might have to sort of come back with more tools at your disposal to beat that boss, I think is something that I don't necessarily like strive for or anything, but I think is interesting enough in its own right to not, you know, rule it out. Alright, couple questions right at the end here from Llama Man. What sort of data schema do you use for inventory items and things like costume pieces in particular? Is it a setup like name, description, effects, picture? Yeah, basically. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff like, what does it salvage into, and what's its stash value, and what's the plural of its name, what type is it, yeah, image, stuff like that. Is it known to the mall? What are requirements for using it? Are costumes an intrinsic part of equipment? No. Or do you just check for individual costume pieces in adventurers? Typically not. I can check for individual equipment pieces. I prefer not to, for a couple of reasons. One of them is it's a lot more intensive on the database than it really needs to be. I mean, you have to, you know, query the player table, well, characters table, and pull out information from there, which is not the end of the world. I mean, it's a really, really simple query, but if I attach a flag to the item, I actually don't have to, and it also makes it work a little more easily in PvP. So, like, even the Tome of Binding, instead of generally, I'm not sure if all of the code got standardized to this. I changed it after I originally put it in, but so originally the Tome of Binding was just like check to see if you have item 81, maybe, is that right? Whatever. If you had item 81 equipped or whatever the number is, and now it checks to see if you have Tome of Binding flag set, which is just, you know, a flag that only appears on that equip. And that's how pretty much all of the outfits work. But yeah, some of the time I do check for individual equipment pieces. It's not as finicky as checking for a item in inventory or a flag, like a like just the flags that say things like you've beaten, you know, X or Y quest. So yeah, at the end, if not, it might be worthwhile for you and easier to change. So it makes requirements like requires 3/3 ISNS and not have to worry about re-adding new equipment to old content. Yeah, no, that's more or less how it works. And you can see that with how some of the outfits have interchangeable pieces. Like I know the serpent scale outfit, you've noticed, does that. Probably the others do as well. Couple things you don't even know are outfits. Like the scuba stuff, which I forget how it's labeled on the wiki, but is just aquatic move in the item database. So yeah, and I can put basically just any arbitrary flag in there. There's a little bit extra if I wanted to count for PvP. That's about it. They're really, really, really fast to access because of the way that they're stored. So, yeah, no, that's how it's set up and how it will probably continue to be set up. At some point, this is totally unrelated, but at some point I'd like to put another item or another couple items into the doctor outfit you use to move around the Slag's lab. Like, bump the requirement up to 3 items and increase.
include various face masks and like first aid type kits and stuff like that. Or maybe 4 items if I really wanted to. But, it's just one of those things that's kicking around that I haven't been sure enough that I want to do to actually implement yet. Okay, well, that is that. I talked some about Halloween. I talked some about the donation item coming up. Some about Christmas. And a couple other things that I might do in November, feeling inspired. But I would expect those to come out after the donation item. And the donation item will include the first season of seasonal runs ending, and the rewards for those, which will be pretty cool. And I'm not sure if by cool there I mean people will actually like them, but I think they're pretty fascinating, so there's that. Okay. Well, so thanks for listening, thanks for playing, and thanks very much for donating, especially the new players, getting some nice donations from folks. If you donate, by the way, and don't get a email, or the, I'm sorry, an in-game message with the unearthly coins you're supposed to get, go ahead and send me a message in-game. It shouldn't take more than, like, 10 or 15 minutes. At the absolute most. It's usually instant. Something with the connection to PayPal seems to be on the fritz. It's like 50-50 right now. And I've been keeping an eye on it, but if anything goes missing, be sure to drop me a line. And, okay, yeah, so, thanks for donating. Long segue. Have a great day. Thanks. I will have another podcast probably in December sometime, maybe during the lead up to Christmas, so we can talk much about snowmen. Thanks. Have a good one.